accession number 19101, Reel 3.
Hans Tesco, Reel 3.
A number of German parachutists were actually in the middle of a dropping zone when the British landed at DPN. They were surprised because they didn't have any inkling of a British parachute drop in the area. So all they could do was go into an Arab hut quickly. And the Arabs reacted by giving them Arab clothing, bits of carpet, anything you can hang on to somebody. And they moved undetected between the British parachutists. They were so busy to collect their weapons and equipment, they couldn't be bothered about looking at some Arabs. That's how ours came back to a place from where they could notify us about the parachute drop that had occurred. In fact, the telephone system was still working there, and I think they telephoned our unit to give the information. Likewise, if we wanted any information about the British, we could phone Algiers or Oran, and we got on any information we wanted from there.
Who from?
From the French people there.
From the people who were manning the phone?
Yeah, yes. So, my battalion commander was Hauptmann Jungwirth. He was a very able man, but he was physically not quite recovered from his injuries in Russia. But nevertheless, he was sent there in the condition he was in, and he was shot in the arm, and his arm was more or less, there was a big hole in his chest and arm. But he was a very, very able man. So he quickly organized whatever he could to attack the landing, or the British forces which had landed there. So he took all parachutists out of the line for a very large area, which was completely left undefended, in other words, and sent them in to concentrate on DPN. He managed to find some troops of Africa March Battalion A24, I believe, and there was a column of self-propelled Italian artillery that were small vehicles with chains and a shield in front of them, which could be mistaken for a tank from a distance, and he stopped them and communicated with the Italian headquarters, telling them that they were needed, and they were put immediately under his command, Jungwirth's command. And there was a part of the Italian 90th Infantry Regiment there, and they were put at Jungwirth's disposal as well. So we had a mixed bag here of German, Italian, infantry, parachutists, artillery, anything which had no initial link of working together practice. So with this people here opposed Frost's parachutists. Now, at DPN, Frost left his people, which were disabled by broken ankles and so on, there, and he had worries about the Arabs. They were hostile towards the British, and he feared that his men, the wounded, maybe massacred. So he left a small group of people behind. There was a platoon of C Company of the Parachute Regiment, 2nd Battalion, which were held up in the airport from which they took off. They had no... it was less than half a platoon left, anyhow, which dropped. And they were all Scotsmen. And they had to defend the wounded in case anything happened. But Jungwirth realized that there were some people there. He had been informed by, again, Arab informers came out and said, there's British there, and this and that. And so he went to that area and was fired on. So there was a short hostile action there, after which the British defenders of the wounded gave up and surrendered. Now, these are the men who were later handed over to first to another German unit and then an Italian unit, and the Italians decided to have them executed because of being saboteurs, according to the Commando Act, which is totally irresponsible and wrong, because they were regular soldiers and not not saboteurs. So people had been taken prisoner. The wounded were cared for. They were taken back to Tunis. The others were taken prisoner and handed to another army unit because we couldn't spare parachutists. So then one of the men volunteered some information where, which was the next objective of Frost, which was Utna, the little airfield there and the railway station. So we managed to catch up with them and engage them in a battle, which was, first of all, as far as we were concerned, it was not an even sort of, let us say, arrangement, because we thought we were more powerful than they were. And they were in a situation whereby anything that was promised to them, like armored support, air force support, and so on, it never materialized. So they had no, they were left on their own devices. And they had, after the first major engagement, where they lost, I think, somewhere in the region of 35 killed, and 200 of them were taken prisoner by us, they decided to try to reach the British lines, because the Utna airfort, which they intended to take with German planes on it, happened to be a deserted airport with what was thought was a German dive bomber, was in fact a Herrig. So there was a small unit under Lieutenant Dennis Randall who attacked Utna Station. It was successful, but he couldn't hold this position because the battalion decided to return to the British lines. Randall, actually, he did a good job there, but he destroyed the telephone link, which we were not very pleased with, because we had good contacts to Algeria and so on. It upset us for a bit, but we managed to get going on another side. So the British parachutists went along a line which was just ahead and not behind our forward positions. So we had a running commentary from the Arabs who told us exactly where the British were. We went at night, in daytime we engaged them in fighting. At night we went to sleep in our French or Arab quarters, wherever we were. And the British tried to march all night long, trying to get to the British lines. Next morning we were refreshed, but they were absolutely beaten, you know, down and out, more or less. In fact, we picked up one or two fast asleep, British parachutists fast asleep. They were exhausted, and they didn't even realize who woke them up. They were so surprised eventually by the time they got back to their senses. And we were marching there. We were following them up and engaging in different places. There was one place where the number two, the adjutant of the 2nd Battalion, Captain Short, was taken prisoner by my company commander, Lieutenant Schuster. He was taken back in a French Citroen, which was requisitioned. There were Schuster and two of our men in it, plus Captain Short and two of his men. And I was just at this post, one of our posts, when Schuster with Short arrived. And they had, Short had a well-deserved sleep, first of all, and his two men had a good sleep. And when they were ready to talk, Schuster, who spoke fluent English as well as French, they exchanged addresses. So after the war, they wanted to meet each other and see each other. But unfortunately, neither of them could honor their promise, because Schuster was taken to Italy as a prisoner and escaped. And at Sulmona railway station, he was shot during the escape attempt. He could have been saved if he would have surrendered, but he didn't. And there had been an incident a few days before where also a British officer, after escaping, were met by a German parachutist, and one of his escaped British soldiers, officers, had an injured foot. So this German parachutist wanted to tend that man's foot, and bent down and had a look at his foot. And all three of them beat that German soldier with anything could get hold of. And the one who, one of the officers said, they beat him until his head was hanging down at a crazy angle. In other words, they killed him, you see. He helped to try to help him, and they killed him. And after that, anyone who was escaping and did not surrender was fired at. Now, Short was in a railway carriage, so they fired into the railway carriage, and he was killed that way. So he could not honor his promise of inviting Lieutenant Schuster after the war, and Schuster could not honor it the other way, because on the 11th of January he was killed at Buarada. So both of them were dead. So I met Captain Short's widow and his daughter, which he had never seen, because his widow was expecting the daughter at the time. I had them visiting me once, and I had from the mother of Lieutenant Schuster, I had a cigarette packet on which they exchanged the addresses. Now, Captain Short, living in Welling in Kent, he was not sure if his house would be standing when the war was finished. So he gave his address as care of Barclays in Welling. And that's how I traced his widow and daughter. And many other incidents happened. So we in the mornings, we were always informed by the Arabs where the British were. So the two men who normally with Schuster went to take Captain Short to the camp, the prisoner of war camp in Tunis, while Schuster remained at the headquarters, head office. So we were called early, I think it was December the 2nd, by an Arab who said he owns a farm, or he lives in a farm, and this farm is occupied by British parachutists, and he quoted somewhere in the region of 35. Now, we normally they exaggerate, so we thought, well, if you say 35, there may be 10 or 15 there, you see. So Schuster and Willy Holzmann, who was a driver of a motorcycle, and I went into the leading motorcycle, a group of five or six motorcycles with machine guns went towards that farm. This just before we got there, we were on top of, just behind the hill, you see it on the other side of the hill, there's a farm. So we left him there in case we didn't want him to get involved in any fighting. So we went onto the farm, and I was in a leading motorcycle with Schuster. There was a French farmer and his daughter coming to meet us. I had caught a cold, so I had to relieve myself, which I couldn't do in front of that farmer and his daughter. So I went past a little farm building and a sort of a barn. And on the other side, there was a hayrick. I went behind there to relieve myself. When I came back, some Arab children had come there as well. And they didn't know the difference from one to another, and we were novelties for them. So they came in between. When I looked up at the children, I saw the open barn door, and I could see a part from a, you know, there was a sunlight and a shadow. I could see a part, the lower part of a British parachutist, and I could see a gun pointing in my direction. And I saw beside him, I saw somebody lying flat on his back with his feet sticking up. Now, I had left my rifle at the sidecar. I didn't have a rifle, but I did have a pistol and a belt. But I said to myself, well, if that one has not shot at me, he didn't want to kill the children or hit the children, which were between us. That's Dennis Randall, by the way. And so he... on the other hand, I said, if I would fire, take some time to get the pistol out of the holster, and the rifle was in the sidecar, I said, this man who is there is British, I can see that. And the one lying beside him is either badly hurt or perhaps even dead. So he has enough problems with his hand, So I said, I ignore him. And I think I nodded in that direction, and to show that I have seen them or something like this. And I went my way. In the meantime, the farmer and his daughter had finished a conversation with Lieutenant Schuster, and we departed again from the farm. And 29 years after that event, I met Lieutenant Steinforth, who was one of the two officers there, and found out more about it. I believe there were about 74 British parachutists in the barn, in the barn buildings there, and most of them were asleep because they were exhausted, but one or two actually saw me, watched me. And so I went my way. We had, behind the hill, we had two armored vehicles there with gun, with the little cannons on it. And we had an anti-aircraft vehicle there with four machine guns, which fire simultaneously. And but I said, now this bloke has enough trouble, and it's only one man, so why bother? Why take a risk? And I just went my way. I never mentioned it, and that's how we parted. But of course, after we left, they left us there. They left the farm as well. But after the war, I managed to get details about the French farmer, his daughter. I know the names, Monsieur Rayborg, and Genevieve Rayborg. And I know that one of the Arab children, who were children at the time, is still living on the farm. And I have a photograph of him standing, as a man, standing in front of the farm building, the barn. So that was, we were also called to another farm, which the British called the Cactus Farm, because there were cactus around it, and we were going there, again, on the request of an Arab who took us there. And he told us that the British had actually shot dead two Arabs, which in fact I had confirmed by members of a 2nd Battalion. They were Arabs who had undressed the bodies of three British pars who had been killed, and came with their uniforms to this farm, which unfortunately for them was held by the British, got there in British uniforms, and were shot as spies. And so I know the man who actually buried them, made a quick burial, because they had to leave that farm within a very short time afterwards. And so we engaged them in a short fight where we lost one man. And they made their retreat. Frost was blowing his hunting horn, which we didn't understand, because in Germany fox hunting was banned, and so nobody knew what it meant. It was a retreat, and it's gone away for huntsmen. On that side, they all took to the hills, and one or two to a Roman ruin. So we followed the ones, but we lost them in the end, in the pitch darkness of night. They made their way back. That's where Frost eventually joined the British forces near Medjez Abab. So that is my experience there on that battle. I don't know if it interests you. When there was one incident, you see, I had to go forward and backwards. If we had a car and we had to pick up some wounded, we put them all in the car, and whoever was with them in the car had to stay behind and wait for the car to come back. And so on that occasion, I was left behind with an Italian unit, and the Italian said, "If you're over there, that must be German parachutists." And he pointed out. I said, "Yes, they are." He said, "They keep on looking at us, and they may think we are Americans, and we don't want them to fire at us." And he said, "Would you take the risk of going to them and let them know that we are Italians here. I said, yes, all right. He said, but every now and again somebody is shooting in that direction. There were the British shooting. But fortunately, I don't know why, but I went there and they picked me up and they were firing at me, but too high, quite high. I don't know why, but anyhow, I got this message across. And they were able to acknowledge each other, and bloodshed was prevented there. When I came back, this Italian officer asked me for my name and rank and so on, and I thought nothing of it. But a few weeks later, I got the Italian War Cross for it, for that action, preventing bloodshed. So,
before you go any further, could I just establish which unit you were with again?
The German 5th Parachute Regiment. We also had, we were also called Sturm Regiment.
And which subunit of the regiment were you in?
I was in the 1st Company. But after DPN, I was attached as a personal dispatcher and runner, what you call it, runner, to Captain Junggrat himself, the battalion commander. So after that, on the odd occasions, I met people of the 1st Company. So after this, we moved into the area which before the Udna or DPN raid was taking place. We moved into the area which we had previously occupied because we had more reinforcements then. So we took up a position first along the area of Pontufars, Tibobo Majors, which is a Roman ruin, a well-known one, and along the main road which went right up to Gubalat and then eventually to Majors Abab. So we had a temporary front line there, and ahead of the positions there was a mud pass, partly a road, running all the way along. So Jungwirth had his headquarters about 10 kilometers from Pontefras towards Tunis. And we had an alarm call once that one of the farms was attacked by the British. And the whole lot, the battalion headquarters, company and so on, and anything we had moved into that direction. And we managed to eject the British, which were part of the London Irish Rifles, which had probed, wanted to find out where we were, you see.
But how difficult was it to eject them?
It was quite, by the time we arrived there, we only had to fire one or two shots off into the direction of shadows which disappeared into the dark. But I remember there were quite a number of bodies left behind. We didn't lose any of ours, but there were quite a number of British bodies left behind. And
is this still December?
That's December. No, just a moment. No, that is January, early January. And the British thought they were way behind our lines, but they still were not, because they were right ahead of our lines. And by pure chance,